This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. And let me start by welcoming the audience here with us in the night studio at the Newseum. Thanks so much for coming in. It's great to have you with us. Well, in just over a month, voters elect the 44th president of the United States, and when he takes office in January, the presidential to-do list might include fixing a lousy economy, fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, disrupting terrorist threats, and settling into the White House. We know a president works on many issues, but most of us really don't know much about what he actually does Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 and beyond. It's the most powerful position in the world, but what does a president really do all day? We'll talk with Joel Achenbach, who wrote about this topic for the Washington Post, and also with John Gardner, who worked side by side with our current president, George W. Bush, and his father, former President George H.W. Bush. Later in the hour, a man who built a career on photographing Muhammad Ali. But first, what do you want to know about what a president really does? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Then the email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now from the night studio at the Newseum is Washington Post staff writer Joel Achenbach. And he wrote an article on this subject called "What Does a President Really Do All Day?" Joel, thanks for joining us.
Lynn, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You inspired this show.
Excellent.
So, all right, if you're the president and your alarm clock goes off, let's say, at around 5 a.m., what do you do first?
Well, this current president is very much a creature of habit, and he gets to the White House, to the Oval Office, about 6:45 in the morning. And it's a great treat, by the way, having someone here, John Gardner, who actually knows this president and also knows his father and how they did the job. So we have a president now who has wanted to be like Reagan, very much a creature of habit, and to stick to a tight schedule. The thing about this campaign season, we do not talk very often about what a president does. What are the skills you need to be a good president? What's it like day to day? We don't know very much about how these candidates make decisions. And you can draw inferences. You see, for example, with Senator McCain, what appears to be a fairly impulsive decision to pick Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate. And that sort of shows you the McCain style, perhaps. Senator Obama seems to be more deliberative, perhaps, but that also can be a weakness if he deliberates too long. President Clinton was famous for not liking to make decisions. And when I did my story, Leon Panetta said that Clinton would make a decision, and then he'd mull it and ponder it and sort of ask, you know, should I have done that? Was that the right decision?
See, that really surprised me when I read that, I have to say.
Yeah.
Because I would think that the one thing that a president really has to be good at is being a decision maker. And I think of President Clinton as having been a decisive person.
Well, I think that when I talked to Panetta, he indicated that making those final decisions was not Bill
easy
Clinton's favorite part
right.
of the job.
Yeah. And the fact that he sort of questioned them afterwards, because it reminded me of myself, you know, I thought that makes me a little nervous.
Well, think about the flip side is if you make a decision too quickly and you're
right.
too stubborn and you stick with it, even when the evidence indicates it was a bad decision, then you could be in even a worse situation.
But let me ask you about a president's routine, because you were saying that this president, and we're going to talk with John Gardner about the details of two presidents' routines in a moment, but it would seem to me, do they all have different styles? Like you were saying, President Bush, the current President Bush, you know, likes to stick with the routine, gets up at a certain time. Is that true of all the presidents, or is some more?
No, I don't think so. I think, for example, President Clinton was famous for not really liking the heavily structured schedule. And what they did after maybe 6 months of running the White House back in 1993 is they realized they had to just open up his schedule and have this vast period of unstructured time in the middle, basically from all afternoon long. And then Clinton would like to stay up late talking on the phone. I mean, you know, people would get the phone call at 2 in the morning. You know, it's the president. He needs someone to talk to. You know, that was his style. But with President Reagan, for example, I looked at his schedules from when he was it was president. And it's amazing how he shows up at the Oval Office at 9 o'clock, 9:02, 9:03, and with him is James Baker, you know, his top aides are with him for all these meetings. It's extremely scheduled throughout the day, and then pretty much 5 o'clock, 5:15, he's out of there.
Yeah. I was very interested in when you wrote about the schedules that it wasn't just arise at 9 o'clock, but arise at 9:01, 9:02, 9:03. And then the next appointment would also be not, you know, at the top of the hour, the bottom of the hour, the quarter of the hour, but down to the minute.
Down to the minute. Oh, yeah, the president's schedule is calculated to the minute. It's very precise. And you have to keep in mind, the job is very hard. It's so easy to get lost in the weeds. There are famous stories about presidents who just were overwhelmed by all the details. And Jimmy Carter always comes up in this conversation,
right,
because he famously approved the sign-up sheet for the White House tennis court. Now, there's been some sort of historical revisionism on this and some debate. Did he really do that? And I believe it's the journalist James Fallows who says he saw Carter's initials on the sign-up sheet for the White House tennis court. Let me tell you a quick story, Lynn. I mentioned in the story, I quote a historian talking about Carter getting enmeshed in the issue of federal cotton dust standards. And so I just put that in the story as sort of a throwaway line. And then I got a phone call after the story ran from Ralph Nader.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a message on my machine at work. He says, you know, Joel, it's Ralph Nader. And he says, federal cotton dust standards were a very important issue. And then he gave me a whole sort of lecture on my machine about why this was a major safety issue. He also objected to the fact that I didn't mention him in my article.
I was going to say, so we've got some idea of what kind of president Ralph Nader would be, yeah, if he ever got anywhere close to the office. All right, let's take a call now. We're going to go to Jeff calling from Huntersville, North Carolina. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I had a question about personal time for a president and the environment they're in. Do they have like a beer fridge? Can they walk into the kitchen and make a sandwich? Or is there people around every corner waiting to wait on them? You know, is there a red phone in the bathroom?
Well, they are human beings like everyone else. So I know that the current president always has a workout period that I assume is on the schedule. But there's never a day when he doesn't have his chance to go work out. But I don't think they have a beer fridge, though. We'll suggest that.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Jeff.
Thank you.
And I'd like to ask John Gardner to join us now. He's with us here at the museum, and he served as deputy staff secretary to both President George H.W. Bush and the current President George W. Bush. Good to have you with us, John.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, we're assuming that the president gets lots of help from staff, so maybe you can explain, what was your role in the White House? What exactly did you do to help the president get through the day?
Well, the office of the staff secretary is really best thought of as the inbox and outbox of the president, that all the material going to and from the president would come through the staff secretary and would then come out from the Oval Office to that office for a number of reasons. First, simply to ensure continuity of decisions and the decisions were taken at an appropriate time. Second, very importantly, to ensure follow-up, that the president would ask certain people to do things, and it was part of that office's job to ensure that the president's questions were answered in a timely manner, or particular actions he wanted to take were in fact done. Also, there was a role of being an honest broker, so that to ensure that the president would get the best advice from all the members of the staff whom he wanted to receive the advice from, and to ensure that everyone had a chance to participate in the process and try to prevent particular offices or agencies from gaming the process in any way.
Now, Joe was talking about the fact that all the presidents have different styles. Can you talk a little bit about the two different personalities and styles of the two presidents you serve, father
sure.
and son?
Sure. I think the styles are actually somewhat similar in that both are morning people, both like to get to the Oval Office pretty early, both creatures of habit, spend the morning reading the press, digesting whatever information they needed before trying to before trying to begin the day. They would have intelligence briefings, national security briefings early in the morning, and then simply proceed with the day. I think in both administrations there was a sense, to if you talk about scheduling to the minute, I think there's also a sort of macro scheduling, if you will, that, you know, what do we need to do in any week? Do we need to have regular meetings with the congressional leadership? We need to have regular meetings with the cabinet members, senior members of the cabinet, and those types of things.
Go ahead, Jim.
Is it true that Bush 43 is so punctual that he will lock the door to the cabinet room right at the time of the appointed meeting? And if you're outside, tough luck.
Well, I hadn't heard the story about locking the door, but certainly I would not want to either be late to a meeting with the president or have my cell phone go off in a meeting with the president.
Okay, what would happen if you were late to a meeting with the president?
I think the president would make his displeasure known in any number of ways.
All right. What about when something really huge happens, you know, as is happening this week with this, you know, the whole bailout package and the debate on Capitol Hill, that obviously there had to be some decision-making going into the fact that the president's going to address the American people tonight. I mean, does the schedule just get blown wide open? What happened?
Yeah, I think that's a great example in that you have a number of things going on at once. We demand a lot from our presidents. One of the functions, obviously, is helping to propose legislation to the Congress. So I'm sure there were a series of meetings last week, very long meetings, in which the president was discussing with Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, Josh Bolton, senior officials like that. Also probably some briefings with the congressional leadership beforehand. And then you take a day like today. Obviously, some time is being carved out in the schedule. I imagine right now the president is probably rehearsing a speech.
Yeah.
And I think that's good because we do judge our presidents on a number of standards, one of which is how he does appear when he presents himself to the American people. So I'm sure it's a very active day at the White House.
All right, we're going to continue talking about the job description of a president, and I'm going to take on the part of President Bush right now and say turn off your cell phones while we take a little break to our audience here. And when we come back, we'll continue this discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We know the President of the United States serves as the head of the executive branch of government, the commander-in-chief of the military, and, of course, he lives in the White House. What most of us don't know is what the president does every day. What is the president's job description? Joel Achenbach wrote the piece, What Does a President Really Do All Day, for the Washington Post, and he's with us at the museum now. And John Gardner worked as deputy staff secretary to both President George H.W. Bush and the current President George W. Bush. What do you want to know about what a president does? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And John Gardner and Joel Achenbach, if you know the answer to this question too, is the president ever alone? Does the president ever have any downtime and time to think? That's what I was wondering.
I think a wise staff would build that into the schedule. And certainly in both the administrations that I saw, there was that time built into the schedule.
But the short answer, I think, is that he's not alone very much. I mean, he's constantly meeting with staff and constantly trying to make decisions or figure out what to do next. I mean, keep one thing in mind about the presidency. It's not just that there is this vast executive branch, which since FDR has been, you know, of such an enormous scale. I mean, FDR basically said, I can't do this alone. And the Brownlee Commission, Lewis Brownlee, headed this commission to create what's called the Executive Office of the Presidency, I believe it was 1939, which is this is different from the White House office. The Executive Office of the Presidency has about 3,000 staffers. And that sort of covers the whole complex over there of the White House and the old executive office building. There's a lot of people working in this operation. It's not like being a senator up on Capitol Hill. And so one thing we should be aware of is that we're going to have a new president in January, and the person in that job will never have done anything remotely like it before.
Mm-hmm. Has no idea what they're really getting into. Would you say that?
I think that's true for any president. And I think, for instance, of Harry Truman, who had been a haberdasher in Missouri, part of the Pendergast machine in Kansas City, was elected to the Senate, did some very good work up there. And when he became president, he said that he felt the stars, the moon, and the planets had fallen on him. And I think that's a feeling that any new president would or should have.
A lot of the President's Day, too, I don't know if it's a lot, how much of the President's Day is really taken up with sort of ceremonial duties, having their photographs taken with people or, you know.
Well, the current president, no one wants to have their picture taken with him anymore.
So I'm not sure that John Gardner would agree with that.
It saves so much time.
You know, I mean, there is a ceremonial aspect of the presidency, and whether it's the, you know, the NCAA basketball team champions or the Olympians or, you know, any number of people. I mean, we expect a lot of our president. We expect the president to, for instance, go to Texas with the Hurricanes. We expect them to meet with famous Americans, cheer on the Olympic team in Beijing. So there definitely is that aspect of the job, and I think it's an important aspect of the job.
All right, let's see if we can get a call in here. We're going to go to Michelle, and she's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
I'm wondering if a day in the life of the president is anything close to what's depicted in the TV series The West Wing. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks for that question, which is no longer on the air, we have to say, at least not in first run.
Well, I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert on the television show, but I think it was written by some people who were fairly knowledgeable about Washington, but I'm sure there is a fair amount of hyperbole in there as well.
Except on the show, I think, aren't the Democrats in power?
Yes.
Well, the Democrats are in power, and a lot of decisions don't resolve themselves within an hour time frame of a TV show.
Okay. So. And let's see, let's go to Michael, who's calling from Winchester, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question. You were speaking about ceremonies. I used to do protocol for some very senior officers in the military, and I recall my direct interaction with them when we were doing event planning. Does the president have direct interaction with his protocol staff?
Well, the president has a fairly large military staff, which supports him not only on the ceremonial aspect of the job, but obviously most immediately on his role as commander in chief, including commander in chief of our nuclear forces. So yes, he does. He and his staff do work with the Military District of Washington on some of the protocol operations. But 95% of the people there are there doing their job as military armed forces.
Is there? Oh, great. Okay.
Did that answer your question, Michael?
Well, it did, but I was just wondering, because generally what would happen is sometimes the preparation may go as far as the chief of staff, and then the chief of staff will brief the president on what's going to happen when he walks through that door. And I was just wondering if the protocol people have the privilege of directly interacting with the president in the planning stages, if there's time for that in the schedule.
Well, they can, absolutely. And I'm reminded of a story of when President Reagan came into office in 1981, and he was going to award a Medal of Honor. I apologize; I cannot remember the name of the person who was honored for his service in Vietnam. And I believe it was either Jim Baker or Ed Meese who came into the, or no, I'm sorry, it was Michael Deaver who came into the Oval Office and said, "This is what we're going to do in this ceremony." And the president said, "Well, you know, Michael, I have a trained acting voice as well." And the president himself wanted to read that citation, which was a lovely moment to start his administration.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Michael.
Thanks.
I'm just going to read this email. This is from Mark, calling from Menlo, writing from Menlo Park, California. My question is that it just seems that presidents and presidential candidates are so much more healthy than the average person. I mean, they appear to always be hale when they have a debate, make a speech, or meet with a foreign leader. The hoarse voice or accidental injury aside, you never see them sneezing or coughing or sick to their stomach. I hope not. Do they get some special shots or vitamins or something that provides the quick cure when they need it?
Well, President Bush, 41, famously had more than an upset stomach when he was in Japan once for a trip and a famous disaster. But, you know, I think one thing I notice about in the last 20 years or so is the rigors of campaigning are so great that, you know, you can't run for president unless you are, you know, really in top shape. And I don't think that would have been the case, you know, for William Howard Taft, for example. That certainly has changed. But yeah, you know, they of course they get sick like anyone else, and you know, President Bush is the current president, you know, uses hand sanitizer to try to keep from getting colds from all the hands he shakes. And they have little tricks. But it's an extremely taxing job, and it's one that, you know, I wish, you know, as a newspaper reporter, I wish that there was a greater percentage of our attention during the campaign devoted to the questions of what will this person's administration actually be like? What are the big issues this person will actually face come January? How will he likely deal with these issues? And we spent less time about dealing with, you know, the gaffe that someone supposedly made on the campaign trail yesterday.
But, you know, I wonder, based on what I think you said before, John Gardner, or maybe you even said it, Joel, which is that they don't really know what they're getting into. I mean, maybe they can't completely answer that question on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly in this year, as Joel was saying, I mean, we have two senators running for the office, and this is the ultimate executive office in the world. So there are different styles of leadership between the executive and the legislative. But I think Joel's right that we probably should, as voters, focus a little more on how they might conduct themselves in office in terms of the leadership styles they.
How would you go about finding that out in a campaign?
Well, one thing you could ask is you could really try to find out how does this person make decisions. I mean, what are they like in a staff meeting? I mean, try to, you know, probe that. I mean, talk to people. Is this person deliberative? Is this person, you know, can he listen to others?
Don't we know a little bit about that, about the two candidates so far?
I think we know some, but yeah. I don't feel like I, just as a citizen, know as much as I'd like to know about what they'd be like in that job. I think, keep in mind, the decisions that reach the president are not the easy decisions. Mm-hmm. They're the hard decisions. The easy ones are already made. And the hard decisions often have people on your own team making, you know, contrary arguments about this, which way to go.
And that's what you want.
Yeah, that's what you want. And, you know, you have to be able to really listen, analyze a lot of input, and make a good judgment and move on. And so I wish I knew more about both McCain and Obama and what they would be like in that role. The other thing that's sort of related tangentially, maybe, is that this week we've seen the entire economy facing a potential crisis. Mm-hmm. It sort of throws out the window so many of the campaign promises of both sides regarding tax cuts and spending. It's important for the American people to tell these candidates, we have to hear what you will really do in this current real landscape, right? Not based on what your position was a year ago.
All right. I think we have Abigail is in the audience, wants to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Abigail Shehe from Draper, Utah. I go to Brigham Young University. I'm wondering, do you have any sort of 9-to-5 schedule for the vice president? And would you say, as you did before, that no one has any idea what they're getting into when they get elected president? Would you say that's also true of the vice presidents that go on to become presidents?
The vice president from 9-to-5 is in an undisclosed location. You're not allowed to know where the vice president is. But no, I think the vice president, this one has more than any one previously, the whole presidential entourage. I mean, I was out in Jackson Hole, and apparently, when Cheney is in Jackson Hole at his house there, the whole valley is swarming with helicopters. I mean, it's as though the president was in town. So, but I don't know about his schedule. Maybe.
Well, I mean, things have changed since 9/11, as Joel's suggesting. But I think really since Vice President Mondale, when the modern vice presidency began, there's been a little bit of a mini White House staff for the Office of the Vice President, National Security Advisor, Congressional Liaison, Domestic Policy Advisor. So the vice president certainly participates in a number of meetings with the president, including meetings with Congress, obviously meetings with foreign leaders, this sort of thing. Often the vice president has a particular role in helping run the political party of the of whatever party is in office. I mean, going around and doing fundraising dinners and the like. In the case certainly of both Quayle and Cheney, the two that I saw, since both of them had very long congressional careers, they were very active in trying to be an intelligence source for what's happening on the Hill, trying to help get the president's programs passed. So I think it's the same mix of the official, the ceremonial, the national security with possibly a little bit more of the political thrown in the vice presidency.
Just to follow up real quick to what John said, prior to Mondale, the vice president was a completely useless person whose job it was just basically step into the presidency if something happened to the president. But Mondale, they finally gave the vice president something to do, and he became essentially kind of a deputy president with his own staff and everything.
Joel Achenbach is a staff writer for the Washington Post Style section. He also has writes on a blog. It's called Achenblog at WashingtonPost.com. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's a question from Shelley in Wisconsin. She wants to know, how many hours does a president work in a typical week?
I think one of the things about the presidency is there's no such thing as a typical week. I can't speak with respect to President Reagan and what you were writing about in your article, but both President Bush 41 and 43 took a lot of homework with them, not the least of which is one of the responsibilities of our office was to prepare a schedule book for the next day with briefing papers and the like so that the president could start the day not having to read the book then, but would have some sense the night before of what was happening and how to prepare for the meeting.
I don't think a president is ever really off work.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, let's take a call now from Rod. Rod's calling from Colorado Springs. Hi, Rod.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I read an article a number of years ago in the Atlantic Monthly that the president's job can either be the hardest or the easiest job in the world because everything is scheduled for you. 24 hours a day, you're told what to say. Everything is written out, exactly what you will say, when to say it, where to stand. Everything that you're going to do, you're led hand in hand. Is that true?
But then life happens. History happens. You're presented with a dilemma that no one foresaw, that's not on the schedule. I don't think the bailout of the financial industry was on anyone's schedule. And if you look at this current president, it doesn't seem like he saw this one coming. My impression, just watching, is that he's turned to Paulson and Bernanke and said, "Okay, you guys take it from here." You cannot schedule, 9/11, totally out of the blue. So I think it looks to me like an incredibly hard job and a high pressure job. And I think whoever has that job in January will need a lot of help.
John Gardner, I'd like to hear your response to that, too.
Yeah, I mean, President Nixon wrote in one of his books that the young staffer who wastes the president's time has just wasted the most valuable commodity in the world. And I think the reason why the president is told all where to go and where to stand and things like that is really to open up time, to free the president to do what we elect him or her to do, which is, as Joel is saying, to make decisions.
Okay, thanks for your call, Joel. And here's from Thomas in Salt Lake City. How much time does the president spend on future or current campaigning? How much time does he spend on politics? Just politics, not policy.
It varies tremendously with the election cycles. One of the functions of the president, one of the informal functions of the president, is really to be the titular head of that particular political party. And I think that's a very legitimate role of the office in a democracy. In a period such as 2002, 2006, the congressional elections, one would expect the president to be out there campaigning for the party. Beyond that, it's fairly minimal compared to the other functions of the office.
But, John, is there any kind of standard for what's an appropriate amount of politicking, partisan politicking by the president? I mean, haven't there been times when people said that, the president should not be using the powers of his office for that bit of fundraising? Isn't there a limit?
Yes, of course there is, and there should be. I think one of the factors that goes into that is, elections are a very important tool for helping the president try to build a majority in Congress to try to get what he wants accomplished.
Does the president ever nap? power naps. They can be good.
Power naps can be a wonderful thing. I think I'd prefer to let each of the presidents speak for themselves on that point.
Yeah, and again, each president has their own style. And I was wondering, Joel, what you were saying before, they're rarely alone. But do some presidents build in just that alone time so they can read and think And
yeah, in fact, it's interesting. I didn't know this until I talked to Robert Draper, who wrote about the current president. The current president is a big reader. He spends a tremendous amount of time reading. That's not his reputation. People think he watches football on TV. Not true. He
reads books. We're going to stop right there. Joel, thanks so much. Joel Achenbach is a staff writer for The Washington Post, former deputy staff secretary to the President's Bush. John Gardner's with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thanks to both of you.